Disc 2.
I learned later that Ivar and Ubba were the two oldest of three brothers and the joint leaders of this Danish army. Ubba was asleep, his black-haired head cushioned by his arms that in turn were resting on the remnants of his meal. But Ivar the Boneless was awake. He had sunken eyes, a face like a skull, yellow hair drawn back to the nape of his neck, and an expression of sullen malevolence. His arms were thick with the golden rings Danes like to wear to prove their prowess in battle, while a gold chain was coiled around his neck. Two men were talking to him. One, standing just behind Ivar, seemed to whisper into his ear, while the other, a worried-looking man, sat between the two brothers. I described all this to Ravan, who wanted to know what the worried man sitting between Ivar and Ubba looked like. "No arm rings," I said, "a gold circlet round his neck. Brown hair, long beard, quite old."
"Everyone looks old to the young," Ravan said. "That must be King Egbert."
King Egbert? I'd never heard of such a person.
"He was Elderman Egbert," Ravan explained. "But he made his peace with us in the winter, and we have rewarded him by making him king here in Northumbria. He is king, but we are the lords of the land."
He chuckled, and young as I was, I understood the treachery involved. Elderman Egbert held estates to the south of our kingdom, and was what my father had been in the north, a great power, and the Danes had suborned him, kept him from the fight, and now he would be called king. Yet it was plain that he would be a king on a short leash.
"If you are to live," Ravan said to me, "then it would be wise to pay your respects to Egbert."
"Live?" I blurted out the word. I'd somehow thought that having survived the battle, then of course I would live. I was a child, someone else's responsibility. But Ravan's words hammered home my reality. I should never have confessed my rank, I thought. Better to be a living slave than a dead elderman.
"I think you'll live," Ravan said. "Ragnar likes you, and Ragnar gets what he wants. He says you attacked him."
"I did, yes."
"He would have enjoyed that. A boy who attacks Earl Ragnar? That must be some boy, eh? Too good a boy to waste on death, he says. But then, my son always had a regrettably sentimental side. I would have chopped your head off. But here you are, alive, and I think it would be wise if you were to bow to Egbert."
Now I think, looking back so far into my past, I've probably changed that night's events. There was a feast, Ivar and Ubba were there, Egbert was trying to look like a king. Ravan was kind to me, but I'm sure I was more confused and far more frightened than I've made it sound. Yet, in other ways, my memories of the feast are very precise. Watch and learn, my father had told me. And Ravan made me watch, and I did learn. I learned about treachery, especially when Ragnar, summoned by Ravan, took me by the collar and led me to the high dais, where, after a surly gesture of permission from Ivar, I was allowed to approach the table. "Lord King," I squeaked, then knelt so that a surprised Egbert had to lean forward to see me. "I am Uhtred of Bebbanburg." I had been coached by Ravan in what I should say. "And I seek your lordly protection." That produced silence, except for the mutter of the interpreter talking to Ivar. Then Ubba awoke, looked startled for a few heartbeats as if he was not sure where he was. Then he stared at me, and I felt my flesh shrivel, for I had never seen a face so malevolent. He had dark eyes and they were full of hate, and I wanted the earth to swallow me. He said nothing, just gazed at me, and touched a hammer-shaped amulet hanging at his neck. Ubba had his brother's thin face, but instead of fair hair drawn back against the skull, he had bushy black hair and a thick beard that was dotted with scraps of food. Then he yawned, and it was like staring into a beast's maw. The interpreter spoke to Ivar, who said something, and the interpreter in turn talked to Egbert, who tried to look stern. "Your father," he said. Chose to fight us. And is dead, I answered, tears in my eyes, and I wanted to say something more. But nothing would come, and instead I just snivelled like an infant, and I could feel Ubba's scorn like the heat of a fire. I coughed angrily at my nose. We shall decide your fate, Egbert said loftily, and I was dismissed. I went back to Ravan, who insisted I tell him what had happened, and he smiled when I described Ubba's malevolent silence.
He's a frightening man, Ravan agreed. To my certain knowledge, he's killed 16 men in single combat, and dozens more in battle. But only when the auguries are good, otherwise he won't fight.
The auguries?
Ubba is a very superstitious young man, Ravan said, but also a dangerous one. If I give you one piece of advice, young Uhtred, it is never, never to fight Ubba. Even Ragnar would fear to do that, and my son fears little.
And Ivar? I asked. Would your son fight Ivar?
The boneless one?
Ravan considered the question.
He too is frightening, for he has no pity, but he does possess sense. Besides, Ragnar serves Ivar if he serves anyone, and they're friends, so they would not fight. But Ubba, only the gods tell him what to do. And you should beware of men who take their orders from the gods. Cut me some of the crackling, boy. I particularly like pork crackling.
I cannot remember now how long I was in Jofarik. I was put to work, that I do remember. My fine clothes were stripped from me and given to some Danish boy, and in their place I was given a flea-ridden shift of tattered wool that I belted with a piece of rope. I cooked Ravan's meals for a few days. Then the other Danish ships arrived and proved to hold mostly women and children, the families of the victorious army. And it was then I understood that these Danes had come to stay in Northumbria. Ravan's wife arrived, a big woman called Gudrun with a laugh that could have felled an ox, and she chivied me away from the cooking fire that she now tended with Ragnar's wife, who was called Sigrid, and whose hair reached to her waist and was the colour of sunlight reflecting off gold. She and Ragnar had two sons and a daughter. Sigrid had given birth to 8 children, but only those 3 had lived. Rorik, his second son, was a year younger than me, and on the very first day I met him, he picked a fight, coming at me in a whirl of fists and feet. But I put him on his back and was throttling the breath out of him when Ragnar picked us both up, crashed our heads together, and told us to be friends. Ragnar's eldest son, also called Ragnar, was 18, already a man, and I did not meet him then, for he was in Ireland where he was learning to fight and to kill so he could become an earl like his father. In time, I did meet Ragnar the Younger, who was very similar to his father, always cheerful, boisterously happy, enthusiastic about whatever needed to be done, and friendly to anyone who paid him respect. Like all the other children, I had work to keep me busy. There was always firewood and water to be fetched, and I spent 2 days helping to burn the green muck from the hull of a beached ship, and I enjoyed that even though I got into a dozen fights with Danish boys, all of them bigger than me. And I lived with black eyes, bruised knuckles, sprained wrists and loosened teeth. My worst enemy was a boy called Sven, who was 2 years older than me and very big for his age, with a round, vacant face, a slack jaw and a vicious temper. He was the son of one of Ragnar's shipmasters, a man called Kjartan. Ragnar owned 3 ships. He commanded one, Kjartan the second, and a tall, weather-hardened man named Egil steered the 3rd. Kjartan and Egil were also warriors, of course, and as shipmasters they led their crews into battle, and so were reckoned important men, their arms heavy with rings, and Kjartan's son Sven took an instant dislike to me. He called me English scum, a goat turd, and dog breath. And because he was older and bigger, he could beat me fairly easily. But I was also making friends, and luckily for me, Sven disliked Rorik almost as much as he hated me, and the 2 of us could just thrash him together. and after a while Sven avoided me unless he was sure I was alone. So apart from Sven, it was a good summer. I never had quite enough to eat. I was never clean. Ragnar made us laugh, and I was rarely unhappy. Ragnar was often absent, for much of the Danish army spent that summer riding the length and breadth of Northumbria to quell the last shreds of resistance. But I heard little news, and no news of Bebbanburg. It seemed the Danes were winning, for every few days another English thane would come to Jofurik and kneel to Egbert, who now lived in the palace of Northumbria's king, though it was a palace that had been stripped of anything useful by the victors. The gap in the city wall had been repaired in a day, the same day that a score of us dug a great hole in the field where our army had fled in panic. We filled the hole with the rotting corpses of the Northumbrian dead. I knew some of them. I suppose my father was among them, but I did not see him. Nor, looking back, did I miss him. He had always been a morose man, expecting the worst and not fond of children. The worst job I was given was painting shields. We first had to boil down some cattle hides to make size, a thick glue that we stirred into a powder we had made from crushing copper ore with big stone pestles, and the result was a viscous blue paste that had to be smeared on the newly made shields. For days afterward, I had blue hands and arms, but our shields were hung on a ship and looked splendid. Every Danish ship had a strake running down each side from which the shields could hang, overlapping as though they were being held in the shield wall. And these shields were for Ubba's craft, the same ship I had burned and scraped clean. Ubba, it seemed, planned to leave and wanted his ship to be beautiful. She had a beast on her prow, a prow that curved like a swan's breast from the waterline, then jutted forward. The beast, half dragon and half worm, was the topmost part, and the whole beast head could be lifted off its stem and stowed in the bilge. "We lift the beast heads off," Ragnar explained to me, "so they don't frighten the spirits." I had learned some of the Danish language by then. "The spirits?" Ragnar sighed at my ignorance. "Every land has its spirits," he said, "its own little gods. And when we approach our own lands, we take off the beast heads so that the spirits aren't scared away." "How many fights have you had today?"
"None."
"They're getting frightened of you.
What's that thing around your neck?"
I showed him. It was a crude iron hammer, a miniature hammer the size of a man's thumb, and the sight of it made him laugh and cuffed me around the head. "We'll make a Dane of you yet," he said, plainly pleased. The hammer was the sign of Thor, who was a Danish god almost as important as Odin, as they called Woden, and sometimes I wondered if Thor was the more important god, but no one seemed to know or even care very much. There were no priests among the Danes, which I liked, because priests were forever telling us not to do things, or trying to teach us to read, or demanding that we pray, and life without them was much more pleasant. The Danes, indeed, seemed very casual about their gods, yet almost everyone wore Thor's hammer. I had torn mine from the neck of a boy who had fought me, and I have it to this day. The stern of Ubba's ship, which curved and reared as high as the prow, was decorated with a carved eagle's head, while at her masthead was a wind vane in the shape of a dragon. The shields were hung on her flanks, though I later learned they were only displayed there for decoration, and that once the ship was underway, the shields were stored inboard. Just underneath the shields were the oar holes, each rimmed with leather, 15 holes on each side. The holes could be stopped with wooden plugs when the ship was under sail, so that the craft could lean with the wind and not be swamped. I helped scrub the whole boat clean, but before we scrubbed her, she was sunk in the river, just to drown the rats and discourage the fleas, and then we boys scraped every inch of wood and hammered wax-soaked wool into every seam, and at last the ship was ready. And that was the day my Uncle Elfric arrived in Jofurik. The first I knew of Elfric's coming was when Ragnar brought me my own helmet, the one with the gilt bronze circlet, and a tunic edged with red embroidery and a pair of shoes. It felt strange to walk in shoes again.
"Tidy your hair, boy," he said.
Then remembered he had the helmet that he'd pushed onto my tousled head.
"Don't tidy your hair," he said, grinning.
"Where are we going?" I asked him.
"To hear a lot of words, boy. To waste our time. You look like a Frankish whore in that robe."
"That bad?"
"That's good, lad. They have great whores in Francia. Plump and pretty and cheap. Come on."
He led me from the river. The city was busy, the shops full, the streets crowded with pack mules. A herd of small, dark-fleeced sheep was being driven to slaughter, and they were the only obstruction that did not part to make way for Ragnar, whose reputation ensured respect. But that reputation was not grim, for I saw how the Danes grinned when he greeted them. He might be called Jarl Ragnar, Earl Ragnar, but he was hugely popular. A jester and fighter who blew through fear as though it were a cobweb. He took me to the palace, which was only a large house, part built by the Romans in stone, and part made more recently in wood and thatch. It was in the Roman part, in a vast room with stone pillars and lime-washed walls, that my uncle waited, and with him was Father Beorca, and a dozen warriors, all of whom I knew, and all of whom had stayed to defend Bebbanburg while my father rode to war. Beorca's crossed eyes widened when he saw me. I must have looked very different, for I was long-haired, sun-darkened, skinny, taller and wilder. Then there was the hammer amulet about my neck, which he saw, for he pointed to his own crucifix, then at my hammer, and looked very disapproving. Aelfric and his men scowled at me as though I had let them down, but no one spoke, partly because Ivar's own guards, all of them tall men, and all of them in mail and helmets and armed with long-shafted war axes, stood across the head of the room, where a simple chair, which now counted as Northumbria's throne, stood on a wooden platform. King Egbert arrived, and with him was Ivar the Boneless and a dozen men, including Ravan, who I had learned was a counsellor to Ivar and his brother. With Ravan was a tall man, white-haired and with a long white beard. He was wearing long robes embroidered with crosses and winged angels, and I later discovered this was Wulfhere, the Archbishop of Jofrek, who, like Egbert, had given his allegiance to the Danes. The king sat, looking uncomfortable, and then the discussion began. They were not there just to discuss me. They talked about which Northumbrian lords were to be trusted, which were to be attacked, what lands were to be granted to Ivar and Ubba, what tribute the Northumbrians must pay, how many horses were to be brought to Jofrek, how much food was to be given to the army, which eldermen were to yield hostages, and I sat bored until my name was mentioned. I perked up then, and heard my uncle propose that I should be ransomed. That was the gist of it, but nothing is ever simple when a score of men decide to argue. For a long time they wrangled over my price, the Danes demanding an impossible payment of 300 pieces of silver, and Aelfric not wanting to budge from a grudging offer of 50. I said nothing, but just sat on the broken Roman tiles at the edge of the hall and listened. 300 became 275, 50 became 60, and so it went on, the numbers edging closer but still wide apart. And then Ravan, who'd been silent, spoke for the first time.
"The Earl Uhtred," he said in Danish,
and that was the first time I heard myself described as an earl, which was a Danish rank,
"has given his allegiance to King Egbert. In that, he has an advantage over you, Aelfric."
The words were translated, and I saw Aelfric's anger when he was given no title. But nor did he have a title, except the one he had granted to himself, and I learned about that when he spoke softly to Beorca, who then spoke up for him.
"The elderman Aelfric," the young priest said, "does not believe that a child's oath is of any significance."
Had I made an oath? I could not remember doing so, though I had asked for Egbert's protection, and I was young enough to confuse the two things. Still, it did not much matter. What mattered was that my uncle had usurped Bebbanburg. He was calling himself Elderman. I stared at him shocked, and he looked back at me with pure loathing in his face.
It is our belief,
Raven said, his blind eyes looking at the roof of the hall that was missing some tiles so that a light rain was spitting through the rafters,
that we would be better served by having our own sworn earl in Bebbanburg, loyal to us, than endure a man whose loyalty we do not know.
Aelfric could feel the wind changing, and he did the obvious thing. He walked to the dais, knelt to Egbert, kissed the king's outstretched hand, and as a reward received a blessing from the archbishop. I will offer 100 pieces of silver, Aelfric said, his allegiance given.
200, Raven said, and a force of 30 Danes to garrison Bebbanburg.
With my allegiance given, Aelfric said angrily, you will have no need of Danes in Bebbanburg. So, Bebbanburg had not fallen, and I doubted it could fall. There was no stronger fortress in all Northumbria, and perhaps in all England. Egbert had not spoken at all, nor did he. But nor had Ivar, and it was plain that the tall, thin, ghost-faced Dane was bored with the whole proceedings, for he jerked his head at Ragnar, who left my side and went to talk privately with his lord. The rest of us waited awkwardly. Ivar and Ragnar were friends. An unlikely friendship, for they were very different men. Ivar all savage silence and grim threat, and Ragnar open and loud. Yet Ragnar's eldest son served Ivar, and was even now at 18 years old, entrusted with the leadership of some of the Danes left in Ireland, who were holding on to Ivar's lands in that island. It was not unusual for eldest sons to serve another lord. Ragnar had two earl's sons in his ship's crews, and both might one day expect to inherit wealth and position if they learned how to fight. So Ragnar and Ivar now talked, and Aelfric shuffled his feet and kept looking at me. Beoka prayed, and King Egbert, having nothing else to do, just tried to look regal. Ivar finally spoke.
The boy is not for sale, he announced.
Ransom,
Raven corrected him gently.
Aelfric looked furious.
I came here, he began,
but Ivar interrupted him.
The boy is not for ransom, he snarled,
then turned and walked from the big chamber. Egbert looked awkward, half rose from the throne, sat again, and Ragnar came and stood beside me.
You're mine, he said softly. I just bought you.
Bought me?
My sword's weight in silver, he said.
Why?
Perhaps I want to sacrifice you to Odin, he suggested, then tousled my hair.
We like you, boy, he said. We like you enough to keep you. And besides, your uncle didn't offer enough silver. For 500 pieces? I'd have sold you for that.
He laughed. Beoka hurried across the room.
Are you well? He asked me.
I'm well, I said.
Thing you're wearing,
he said, meaning Thor's hammer, and he reached as though to pull it from its thong.
Touch the boy priest, Ragnar said harshly, and I'll straighten your crooked eyes before opening you from your gutless belly to your skinny throat.
Beoka, of course, could not understand what the Dane had said, but he could not mistake the tone, and his hand stopped an inch from the hammer. He looked nervous. He lowered his voice so only I could hear him.
Your uncle will kill you, he whispered.
Kill me?
He wants to be Elderman. That's why he wished to ransom you, so he could kill you.
But,
I began to protest.
Shh,
Beoka said. He was curious about my blue hands, but did not ask what had caused them.
I know you are the Elderman, he said instead, and we will meet again.
He smiled at me, glanced warily at Ragnar and backed away. Aelfric left. I learned later that he'd been given safe passage to and from Jofurik, which promise had been kept, but after that meeting he retreated to Bebbanburg and stayed there. Ostensibly he was loyal to Egbert, which meant he accepted the overlordship of the Danes, but they had not yet learned to trust him. That, Ragnar explained to me, was why he had kept me alive. "I like Bebbanburg," he told me. "I want it." "It's mine," I said stubbornly. "And you're mine," he said, "which means Bebbanburg is mine. You're mine, Uhtred, because I just bought you, so I can do whatever I like with you. I can cook you if I want, except there's not enough meat on you to feed a weasel. Now take off that whore tunic, give me the shoes and helmet, and go back to work." So I was a slave again, and happy. Sometimes when I tell folk my story, they ask why I did not run away from the pagans, why I did not escape southwards into the lands where the Danes did not yet rule. But it never occurred to me to try. I was happy. I was alive. I was with Ragnar, and it was enough. More Danes arrived before winter. 36 ships came, each with its contingent of warriors, and the ships were pulled onto the riverbank for the winter while the crews, laden with shields and weapons, marched to wherever they would spend the next few months. The Danes were casting a net over eastern Northumbria, a light one, but still a net of scattered garrisons. Yet they could not have stayed if we had not let them. But those eldermen and thanes who had not died at Jofrek had bent the knee, and so we were a Danish kingdom now, despite the leashed Egbert on his pathetic throne. It was only in the west, in the wilder parts of Northumbria, that no Danes ruled. But nor were there any strong forces in those wild parts to challenge them. Ragnar took land west of Jofrek, up in the hills. His wife and family joined him there, and Ravan and Gudrun came, plus all Ragnar's ship's crews who took over homesteads in the nearby valleys. Our first job was to make Ragnar's house larger. It had belonged to an English thane who had died at Jofrek, but it was no grand hall, merely a low wooden building thatched with rye straw and bracken, on which grass grew so thickly that from a distance the house looked like a long hummock. We built a new part, not for us, but for the few cattle, sheep and goats who would survive the winter and give birth in the new year. The rest were slaughtered. Ragnar and the men did most of the killing, but as the last few beasts came to the pen, he handed an axe to Rorik, his younger son. One clean, quick stroke, he ordered, and Rorik tried, but he was not strong enough and his aim was not true, and the animal bellowed and bled, and it took 6 men to restrain it while Ragnar did the job properly. The skinners moved on to the carcass, and Ragnar held the axe to me. "See if you can do better." A cow was pushed toward me. A man lifted her tail. She obediently lowered her head, and I swung the axe, remembering exactly where Ragnar had hit each time, and the heavy blade swung true, straight into the spine just behind the skull, and she went down with a crash. "We'll make a Danish warrior of you yet," Ragnar said, pleased. The work lessened after the cattle slaughter. The English, who still lived in the valley, brought Ragnar their tribute of carcasses and grain, just as they would have delivered the supplies to their English lord. It was impossible to read from their faces what they thought of Ragnar and his Danes, but they gave no trouble, and Ragnar took care not to disturb their lives. The local priest was allowed to live and give services in his church that was a wooden shed decorated with a cross, and Ragnar sat in judgment on disputes, but always made certain he was advised by an Englishman who was knowledgeable in the local customs. "You can't live somewhere," he told me, "if the people don't want you to be there. They can kill our cattle or poison our streams, and we would never know who did it. You either slaughter them all or learn to live with them." The sky grew paler and the wind colder. Dead leaves blew in drifts. Our main work now was to feed the surviving cattle and to keep the log pile high. A dozen of us would go up into the woods, and I became proficient with an axe, learning how to bring a tree down with an economy of strokes.
We would harness an ox to the bigger trunks to drag them down to the shealing, and the best trees were put aside for building, while the others were split and chopped for burning. There was also time for play, and so we children made our own hall high up in the woods. A hall of unsplit logs with a thatch of bracken, and a badger's skull nailed to the gable in imitation of the boar's skull that crowned Ragnar's home. And in our pretend hall, Rorik and I fought over who would be king, though Thyra, his sister who was 8 years old, was always the lady of the house. She would spin wool there, because if she did not spin enough thread by winter's end she would be punished, and she would watch while we boys fought our mock battles with toy wooden swords. Most of the boys were servants' sons or slave children, and they always insisted I was the English chief while Rorik was the Danish leader, and my war band only received the smallest, weakest boys, and so we nearly always lost. And Thyra, who had her mother's pale gold hair, would watch and spin, ever spinning, the distaff in her left hand while her right teased the thread out of a sheared fleece. Every woman had to spin and weave. Ragnar reckoned it took 5 women, or 12 girls, a whole winter to spin enough thread to make a new sail for a boat. And boats were always needing new sails, and so the women worked every hour the gods sent. They also cooked, boiled walnut shells to dye the new thread, picked mushrooms, tanned the skins of the slaughtered cattle, collected the moss we used for wiping our arses, rolled beeswax into candles, malted the barley, and placated the gods. There were so many gods and goddesses, and some were peculiar to our own house, and those the women celebrated in their own rites, while others, like Odin and Thor, were mighty and ubiquitous. But they were rarely treated in the same way that the Christians worshipped their god. A man would appeal to Thor, or to Loki, or to Odin, or to Vikir, or to any of the other great beings who lived in Asgard, which seemed to be the heaven of the gods. But the Danes did not gather in a church as we had gathered every Sunday and every Saints' Day in Bebbanburg. And just as there were no priests among the Danes, nor were there any relics or sacred books, I missed none of it. I wish I had missed Sven, but his father, Kjartan, had a home in the next valley, and it did not take long for Sven to discover our hall in the woods, and as the first winter frosts crisped the dead leaves and the berries shone on hawthorn and holly, we found our games turning savage. We no longer split into 2 sides, because we now had to fight off Sven's boys who would come stalking us. But for a time no great damage was done. It was a game after all, just a game. But one Sven won repeatedly. He stole a badger's skull from our gable, which we replaced with a fox's head, and Thyra shouted at Sven's boys, skulking in the woods, that she had smeared the fox skull with poison, and we thought that very clever of her, but next morning we found our pretend hall burned to the ground.
A hall burning, Rorik said bitterly.
Hall burning?
It happens at home, Rorik explained. You go to an enemy's hall and burn it to the ground. But there's one thing about a hall burning. You have to make sure everyone dies. If there are any survivors, then they'll take revenge. So you attack at night, surround the hall, and kill everyone who tries to escape the flames.
But Sven had no hall. There was his father's house, of course. And for a day we plotted revenge on that, discussing how we would burn it down and spear the family as they ran out. But it was only boastful boy talk, and of course nothing came of it. Instead, we built ourselves a new hall, higher in the woods. It was not as fanciful as the old, not nearly so weathertight, really nothing more than a crude shelter of branches and bracken. But we nailed a stoat's skull to its makeshift gable and assured ourselves that we still had our kingdom in the hills. But nothing short of total victory would satisfy Sven. And a few days later, when our chores were done, just Rorik, Thyra and I went up to our new hall. Thyra spun while Rorik and I argued over where the best swords were made, he saying it was Denmark and I claiming the prize for England, neither of us old enough or sensible enough to know that the best blades come from Francia. And after a while, we got tired of arguing and picked up our sharpened ash poles that served as play spears and decided to look for the wild boar that sometimes trampled through the wood at nightfall. We would not have dared try to kill a boar. They were much too big, but we pretended we were great hunters, and just as we two great hunters were readying to go into the woods, Sven attacked. Just him and two of his followers. But Sven, instead of carrying a wooden sword, swung a real blade, long as a man's arm, the steel glittering in the winter light, and he ran at us, bellowing like a madman. Rorik and I, seeing the fury in his eyes, ran away. He followed us, crashing through the wood like the wild boar we had wanted to stalk, and it was only because we were much faster that we got away from that wicked blade. And then a moment later, we heard Thyra scream. We crept back, cautious of the sword that Sven must have taken from his father's house, and when we reached our pathetic hut, found that Thyra was gone. Her distaff was on the floor, and her wool was all speckled with dead leaves and pieces of twig. Sven had always been clumsy in his strength, and he had left a trail through the woods that was easy enough to follow. And after a while, we heard voices. We kept following, crossing the ridgetop where beeches grew, then down into our enemy's valley. And Sven did not have the sense to post a rear guard who would have seen us. Instead, reveling in his victory, he'd gone to the clearing that must have been his refuge in the wood, because there was a stone hearth in the center. And I remember wondering why we had never built a similar hearth for ourselves. He had tied Thyra to a tree and stripped the tunic from her upper body. There was nothing to see there. She was just a small girl, only 8 years old, and thus 4 or 5 years from being marriageable. But she was pretty, and that was why Sven had half-stripped her. I could see that Sven's two companions were unhappy. Thyra, after all, was Earl Ragnar's daughter, and what had started as a game was now dangerous. But Sven had to show off. He had to prove he had no fear. He had no idea Rorik and I were crouched in the undergrowth, and I do not suppose he would have cared if he had known. He had dropped the sword by the hearth, and now he planted himself in front of Thyra and took down his breeches. "Touch it," he ordered her. One of his companions said something I could not hear. "She won't tell anyone," Sven said confidently, "and we won't hurt her." He looked back to Thyra. "I won't hurt you if you touch it." It was then that I broke cover. I was not being brave. Sven's companions had lost their appetite for the game. Sven himself had his breeches round his ankles, and his sword was lying loose in the clearing's center, and I snatched it up and ran at him. He somehow kept his feet as he turned. "I'll touch it," I shouted, and I swung the long blade at his prick. But the sword was heavy. I'd not used a man's blade before, and instead of hitting where I'd aimed, I sliced it down his bare thigh, opening the skin, and I swung it back, using all my strength, and the blade chopped into his waist where his clothes took most of the force. He fell over, shouting, and his two friends dragged me away as Rorik went to untie his sister. That was all that happened. Sven was bleeding, but he managed to pull up his breeches, and his friends helped him away. And Rorik and I took Thyra back to the homestead, where Ravan heard Thyra's sobs and our excited voices and demanded silence.
"Uhtred," the old man said sternly, "you will wait by the pigsties. Rorik, you will tell me what happened."
I waited outside as Rorik told what had happened. Then Rorik was sent out and I was summoned indoors to recount the afternoon's escapade. Thyra was now in her mother's arms, and her mother and grandmother were furious.
"You tell the same tale as Rorik,"
Ravan said when I had finished.
"Because it's the truth," I said.
"So it would seem."
"He raped her," Sigrid insisted.
"No," Ravan said firmly. "Thanks to Uhtred, he did not."
That was the story Ragnar heard when he returned from hunting, and as it made me a hero, I did not argue against its essential untruth, which was that Sven would not have raped Thyra, for he would not have dared. His foolishness knew few limits. But limits there were, and committing rape on the daughter of Earl Ragnar, his father's warlord, was beyond even Sven's stupidity.
Yet he had made an enemy. And, next day, Ragnar led 6 men to Kjartan's house in the neighbouring valley. Rorik and I were given horses and told to accompany the men, and I confess I was frightened. I felt I was responsible. I had, after all, started the games in the high woods, but Ragnar did not see it that way.
You haven't offended me. Sven has.
He spoke darkly, his usual cheerfulness gone.
You did well, Uhtred. You behaved like a Dane.
There was no higher praise he could have given me, and I sensed he was disappointed that I had charged Sven instead of Rorik. But I was older and much stronger than Ragnar's younger son, so it should have been me who fought. We rode through the cold woods, and I was curious because 2 of Ragnar's men carried long branches of hazel that were too spindly to use as weapons. But what they were for I did not like to ask, because I was nervous. Kjartan's homestead was in the fold of the hills beside a stream that ran through pastures where he kept sheep, goats and cattle. Though most had been killed now, and the few remaining animals were cropping the last of the year's grass. It was a sunny day, though cold. Dogs barked as we approached, but Kjartan and his men snarled at them and beat them back to the yard beside the house where he had planted an ash tree that did not look as though it would survive the coming winter. And then, accompanied by 4 men, none of them armed, he walked toward the approaching horsemen. Ragnar and his 6 men were armed to the hilt with shields, swords, and war axes, and their broad chests were clad in mail, while Ragnar was wearing my father's helmet that he had purchased after the fighting at Jofurik. It was a splendid helmet, its crown and facepiece decorated with silver, and I thought it looked better on Ragnar than it had on my father. Kjartan, the shipmaster, was a big man, taller than Ragnar, with a flat, wide face like his son's, and small, suspicious eyes, and a huge beard. He glanced at the hazel branches and must have recognized their meaning, for he instinctively touched the hammer charm hanging on a silver chain about his neck. Ragnar curbed his horse, and, in a gesture that showed his utter contempt, he tossed down the sword that I'd carried back from the clearing where Sven had tied Thyra. By rights, the sword belonged to Ragnar now, and it was a valuable weapon with silver wire wrapped around its hilt, but he tossed the blade at Kjartan's feet, as though it were nothing more than a hay knife. Your son left that on my land, he said, and I would have words with him. My son is a good boy, Kjartan said stoutly, and in time he will serve at your oars and fight in your shield wall. He has offended me. He meant no harm, Lord. He has offended me, Ragnar repeated harshly. He looked on my daughter's nakedness and showed her his own. And he was punished for it, Kjartan said, giving me a malevolent glance. Blood was shed. Ragnar made an abrupt gesture, and the hazel branches were dropped to the ground. That was evidently Ragnar's answer, which made no sense to me, but Kjartan understood. As did Rorik, who leaned over and whispered to me, that means he must fight for Sven now. Fight for him? They mark a square on the ground with the branches, and they fight inside the square. Yet no one moved to arrange the hazel branches into a square. Instead, Kjartan walked back to his house and summoned Sven, who came limping from under the low lintel, his right leg bandaged. He looked sullen and terrified, and no wonder, for Ragnar and his horsemen were in their war glory, shining warriors, sword Danes. Say what you have to say, Kjartan said to his son. Sven looked up at Ragnar.
I am sorry, he mumbled.
I can't hear you. Ragnar snarled.
I am sorry, Lord, Sven said, shaking with fear.
Sorry for what? Ragnar demanded.
For what I did.
And what did you do?
Sven found no answer, or none that he cared to make, and instead he shuffled his feet and looked down at the ground. Cloud shadows raced across the far moor, and 2 ravens beat up to the head of the valley.
You laid hands on my daughter, Ragnar said. And you tied her to a tree, and you stripped her naked.
Half naked,
Sven muttered, and for his pains took a thump on the head from his father. A game, Kjartan appealed to Ragnar. Just a game, Lord. No boy plays such games with my daughter, Ragnar said.
I had rarely seen him angry, but he was angry now. Grim and hard, no trace of the big-hearted man who could make a hall echo with laughter. He dismounted and drew his sword, his battle blade called Heartbreaker, and he held the tip toward Kjartan.
Well, he asked, do you dispute my right?
No, Lord, Kjartan said,
but he is a good boy, strong and a hard worker, and he will serve you well. And he has seen things he should not see, Ragnar said.
And he tossed Heartbreaker into the air so that her long blade turned in the sun, and he caught her by the hilt as she dropped. But now he was holding her backward, as if she were a dagger rather than a sword.
Uhtred, Ragnar called, making me jump. He says she was only half naked. Is that true?
Yes, Lord.
Then only half a punishment, Ragnar said,
and he drove the sword forward, hilt first straight into Sven's face. The hilts of our swords are heavy, sometimes decorated with precious things, but however pretty they appear, the hilts are still brutal lumps of metal, and Heartbreaker's hilt, banded with silver, crushed Sven's right eye. Crushed it to jelly, blinding it instantly. And Ragnar spat at him, then slid his blade back into its fleece-lined scabbard. Sven was crouching, whimpering, his hands clasped over his ruined eye.
It is over, Ragnar said to Kjartan.
Kjartan hesitated. He was angry, shamed, and unhappy, but he could not win a trial of strength with Earl Ragnar, and so, at last, he nodded.
It is over,
he agreed.
And you no longer serve me, Ragnar said coldly. We rode home.
The hard winter came. The brooks froze. Snow drifted to fill the stream beds, and the world was cold, silent, and white. Wolves came to the edge of the woods, and the midday sun was pale, as though its strength had been leached away by the north wind. Ragnar rewarded me with a silver arm ring, the first I ever received, while Kjartan was sent away with his family. He would no longer command one of Ragnar's ships, and he would no longer receive a share of Ragnar's generosity, for now he was a man without a lord, and he went to Jofrek, where he joined the garrison holding the town. It was not a prestigious job. Any Dane with ambition would rather serve a lord like Ragnar who could make him rich, while the men guarding Jofrek were denied any chance of plunder. Their task was to watch across the flat fields outside the city, and to make certain that King Egbert fomented no trouble. But I was relieved that Sven was gone, and absurdly pleased with my arm ring. The Danes loved arm rings. The more a man possessed, the more he was regarded, for the rings came from success. Ragnar had rings of silver and rings of gold, rings carved as dragons and rings inlaid with glittering stones. When he moved, you could hear the rings clinking. The rings could be used as money if there were no coins. I remember watching a Dane take off an arm ring and hack it to shreds with an axe, then offer a merchant scraps of the ring until the scales showed he had paid sufficient silver. That was down in the bigger valley, in a large village where most of Ragnar's younger men had settled, and where traders brought goods from Jofrek. The incoming Danes had found a small English settlement in the valley, but they needed more space for new houses, and to make it, they had burned down a grove of hazels. And that was what Ragnar called the place, Sinningthwaite, which meant the place cleared by fire. Doubtless the village had an English name, but it was already being forgotten. We're in England to stay now, Ragnar told me as we went home one day, after buying supplies in Sinningthwaite. The road was a track pounded in the snow, and our horses picked a careful path between the drifts through which the black twigs of the hedge tops just showed. I was leading the two pack horses, laden with their precious bags of salt, and asking Ragnar my usual questions. Where swallows went in winter, why elves gave us hiccups, and why Ivar was called the Boneless. "Because he's so thin, of course," Ragnar said, "so that he looks as if you could roll him up like a cloak." "Why doesn't Ubba have a nickname?"
"He does. He's called Ubba the Horrible."
He laughed because he had made the nickname up, and I laughed because I was happy. Ragnar liked my company, and, with my long fair hair, men mistook me for his son, and I liked that. Rorik should have been with us, but he was sick that day, and the women were plucking herbs and chanting spells.
"He's often sick," Ragnar said. "Not like Ragnar."
He meant his eldest son, who helped hold on to Ivar's lands in Ireland.
"Ragnar built like an ox," he went on. "Never gets sick. He's like you, Uhtred."
He smiled, thinking of his eldest son, whom he missed. "He'll take land and thrive. But Rorik? Perhaps I shall have to give him this land. He can't go back to Denmark."
"Why not?"
"Denmark is bad land," Ragnar explained. "It's either flat and sandy, and you can't grow a fart on that sort of field. Or across the water, it's great steep hills with little patches of meadow, where you work like a dog and starve."
"Across the water?" I asked. And he explained that the Danes came from a country that was divided into two parts, and the two parts were surrounded by countless islands, and that the nearer part from where he came was very flat and very sandy, and that the other part, which lay to the east, across a great sound of water, was where the mountains were.
"And there are Sveyr there too," he went on.
"Sveyr?" "A tribe, like us. They worship Thor and Odin, but they speak differently," he shrugged. "We get along with the Sveyr and with the Norse."
The Sveyr, the Norse, and the Danes were the Northmen, the men who went on Viking expeditions. But it was the Danes who had come to take my land, though I did not say that to Ragnar. I had learned to hide my soul. Or perhaps I was confused. Northumbrian or Dane? Which was I? What did I want to be?
"Suppose," I asked, "that the rest of the English do not want us to stay here."
I used the word us deliberately.
He laughed at that. "The English can want what they like, but you saw what happened at Jorvik."
That was how the Danes pronounced Jofurik. For some reason they found that name difficult, so they said Jorvik instead.
"Who was the bravest English fighter at Jorvik?" Ragnar asked.
"You, a child. You charged me with that little saxe. It was a gutting knife, not a sword, and you tried to kill me."
I almost died laughing.
He leaned over and cuffed me affectionately.
"Of course the English don't want us here," he went on. "But what can they do? Next year we'll take Mercia, then East Anglia, and finally Wessex."
"My father always said Wessex was the strongest kingdom," I said. My father had said nothing of the sort. Indeed, he despised the men of Wessex because he thought them effete and overpious. But I was trying to provoke Ragnar. I failed.
"It's the richest kingdom," he said. "But that doesn't make it strong. Men make a kingdom strong, not gold."
He grinned at me.
"We're the Danes. We don't lose, we win. And Wessex will fall."
"It will?"
"It has a new weak king," he said dismissively. "And if he dies, then his son is a mere child. So perhaps they'd put the new king's brother on the throne instead. We'd like that."
"Why?"
"Because the brother is another weakling. He's called Alfred."
Alfred. That was the first time I ever heard of Alfred of Wessex. I thought nothing of it at the time. Why should I have?
"Alfred," Ragnar continued scathingly. "All he cares about is rotting girls, which is good. Don't tell Sigrid I said that. But there's nothing wrong with unsheathing the sword when you can. But Alfred spends half his time rotting and the other half praying to his god to forgive him for rotting.
How can a god disapprove of a good hump?
How do you know about Alfred? I asked.
Spies, Uhtred. Spies. Traders, mostly. They talk to folk in Wessex. So we know all about King Ethelred and his brother Alfred. And Alfred's sick as a stoat half the time.
He paused, perhaps thinking of his younger son who was ill.
It's a weak house, he went on, and the West Saxons should get rid of them and put a real man on the throne. Except they won't, and when Wessex falls, there will be no more England.
Perhaps they'll find their strong king, I said.
No, Ragnar said firmly. In Denmark, he went on, our kings are the hard men. And if their sons are soft, then a man from another family becomes king. But in England, they believe the throne passes through a woman's legs, so a feeble creature like Alfred could become king just because his father was a king.
You have a king in Denmark?
A dozen. I could call myself king if I fancied, except Ivar and Ubba might not like it, and no man offends them lightly.
I rode in silence, listening to the horses' hooves crunching and squeaking in the snow. I was thinking of Ragnar's dream, the dream of no more England, of her land given to the Danes.
What happens to me? I finally blurted out.
You? He sounded surprised that I had asked.
What happens to you, Uhtred, is what you make happen. You will grow. You will learn the sword. You will learn the way of the shield wall. You will learn the oar. You will learn to give honor to the gods. And then you will use what you have learned to make your life good or bad.
I want Bebbanburg, I said.
Then you must take it. Perhaps I will help you, but not yet. Before that, we go south. And before we go south, we must persuade Odin to look on us with favor.
I still did not understand the Danish way of religion. They took it much less seriously than we English. But the women prayed often enough. And once in a while, a man would kill a good beast, dedicate it to the gods, and mount its bloody head above his door to show that there would be a feast in Thor or Odin's honor in his house. But the feast, though it was an act of worship, was always the same as any other drunken feast. I remember the Yule feast best, because that was the week Wayland came. He arrived on the coldest day of the winter, when the snow was heaped in drifts. And he came on foot, with a sword by his side, a bow on his shoulder, and rags on his back. And he knelt respectfully outside Ragnar's house. Sigrid made him come inside, and she fed him and gave him ale. But when he had eaten, he insisted on going back into the snow and waiting for Ragnar, who was up in the hills hunting. Wayland was a snake-like man. That was my very first thought on seeing him. He reminded me of my uncle Aelfric, slender, sly, and secretive, and I disliked him on sight, and I felt a flicker of fear as I watched him prostrate himself in the snow when Ragnar returned.
My name is Wayland, he said, and I am in need of a lord.
You are not a youth, Ragnar said, so why do you not have a lord?
He died, lord, when his ship sank.
Who was he?
Snorri, lord.
Which Snorri?
Son of Eric, son of Grim, from Birka.
And you did not drown? Ragnar asked as he dismounted and gave me the reins of his horse.
I was ashore, lord. I was sick.
Your family? Your home?
I am son of Godfred, lord, from Heitabu.
Heitabu, Ragnar said sourly. A trader.
I am a warrior, lord.
So why come to me?
Wayland shrugged.
Men say you are a good lord, a ring-giver. But if you turn me down, lord, I shall try other men.
And you can use that sword, Wayland Godfredson?
As a woman can use her tongue, lord.
You're that good, eh? Ragnar asked, as ever unable to resist a jest.
He gave Wayland permission to stay, sending him to Sinningthwaite to find shelter. And afterward, when I said I did not like Wayland, Ragnar just shrugged and said the stranger needed kindness. We were sitting in the house, half choking from the smoke that writhed about the rafters. "There is nothing worse, Uhtred," Ragnar said, "than for a man to have no lord, no ring-giver," he added, touching his own arm rings. "I don't trust him," Sigrid put in from the fire, where she was making bannocks on a stone. Rorik, recovering from his sickness, was helping her, while Thyra, as ever, was spinning. "I think he's an outlaw," Sigrid said. "He probably is," Ragnar allowed. "But my ship doesn't care if its oars are pulled by outlaws." He reached for a bannock and had his hand slapped away by Sigrid, who said the cakes were for Yule. The Yule feast was the biggest celebration of the year, a whole week of food and ale and mead and fights and laughter and drunken men vomiting in the snow. Ragnar's men gathered at Sinningthwaite, and there were horse races, wrestling matches, competitions in throwing spears, axes and rocks, and my favourite, the tug of war, where two teams of men or boys tried to pull the other into a cold stream. I saw Wayland watching me as I wrestled with a boy a year older than me. Wayland already looked more prosperous. His rags were gone, and he wore a cloak of fox fur. I got drunk that Yule for the first time, helplessly drunk so that my legs would not work, and I lay moaning with a throbbing head, and Ragnar roared with laughter and made me drink more mead until I threw up. Ragnar, of course, won the drinking competition, and Raven recited a long poem about some ancient hero who killed a monster, and then the monster's mother, who was even more fearsome than her son. But I was too drunk to remember much of it. And after the Yule feast, I discovered something new about the Danes and their gods, for Ragnar had ordered a great pit dug in the woods above his house, and Rorik and I helped make the pit in a clearing. We axed through tree roots, shoveled out earth, and still Ragnar wanted it deeper, and he was only satisfied when he could stand in the base of the pit and not see across its lip. A ramp led down into the hole, beside which was a great heap of excavated soil. The next night, all Ragnar's men, but no women, walked to the pit in the darkness. We boys carried pitch-soaked torches that flamed under the trees, casting flickering shadows that melted into the surrounding darkness. The men were all dressed and armed as though they were going to war. Blind Raven waited at the pit, standing at the far side from the ramp, and he chanted a great epic in praise of Odin. On and on it went, the words as hard and rhythmic as a drum beat, describing how the great god had made the world from the corpse of the giant Ymir, and how he had hurled the sun and moon into the sky, and how his spear Gungnir was the mightiest weapon in creation, forged by dwarves in the world's deeps. And on the poem went, and the men gathered around the pit seemed to sway to the poem's pulse, sometimes repeating a phrase. And I confess I was almost as bored as when Beoka used to drone on in his stammering Latin, and I stared out into the woods, watching the shadows, wondering what things moved in the dark, and thinking of Shea Dugengen.
End of Disc 2.